Patrick, who you might know as the Jewel in the film The Jewel of the Nile. He was the Sufi holy man who saved the day by performing a miracle. Avner the Eccentric is one of the critically acclaimed new vaudevillians. New vaudeville is the term that's been used to describe the rebirth of juggling, magic, and acrobatics by performers who use their skills in the service of humor, irony, theater, and even metaphysical statements. Avner the Eccentric has described his act as Emmett Kelly doing Samuel Beckett. Theater critic John Simon described him as a young man bringing his ancient crafts a new kind of intelligence. It is fundamentally a thinking man's clowning, a philosophical, indeed, dialectical tomfoolery, unquote. On stage, Avner wears a red bulb clown's nose, a bowler hat, and baggy pants held up by suspenders, and he doesn't speak during the performance. Avner's birth name is Eisenberg. He grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and after graduation from the University of Washington with a BA in liberal arts, he went to Paris to study mime and movement with Jacques Lecoq. His recent theater credits include co-starring with the Flying Karamazov Brothers in the Goodman Theater production of The Comedy of Errors, and co-starring in the 1984 Summer Olympics Arts Festival, Pittsburgh Public Theater production of Waiting for Godot, in which he played Estragon. His off-Broadway show ran for 1 year. Avner the Eccentric is in Philadelphia with the Mime and Clown Festival. This is a festival that's going to run from June 13th through July 11th. It will feature master classes, 20 performances held at the Annenberg Center and the Painted Bride Art Center, plus a three-day conference. There's a lot happening, so what I'll do is give you a phone number for more information. It's 751-0131. That's 751-0131. And Avner the Eccentric will perform June 27th at the Annenberg Center in West Philadelphia. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. You said a mouthful.
Yeah. Let's start with your name. Avner's your real name.
Yeah, my Hebrew name.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And the Eccentric. Does that have any vaudeville roots to it?
Yeah, I think it does. I actually got it from an old poster of W.C. Fields. He used to call himself the Eccentric Juggler. And I found out since then that it's an old vaudeville circus term for kind of comic solo performers who usually worked with problems of balance and derived their frustrations from their props rather than their partners. So Ray Bolger was called an eccentric dancer, W.C. Fields an eccentric juggler. And I liked it. It always had a nice ring to me as connoting someone who was slightly off-center, which is what it means in physics, but not harmful.
And how does that apply to your performance, that sense of being off-center or off-balance?
Someone once described me as a juggler with a, how did they say it, an unusual sense of physics. I do a lot of balancing in the show, both sort of psychologically and physically balancing. I think it came at a time when I was really striving to describe myself, and it actually came as Avner the Eccentric Mime. I used to do a lot more mime in the show, but I wasn't doing whiteface, and I was working with props a lot. And this was a time when mimes didn't work with props. So I called myself the Eccentric Mime and then dropped the mime when I quit doing it so much.
Now, Avner is your Hebrew name, and Eisenberg is certainly a very Jewish-sounding name. And whether this is true or not, I don't think of there as having been a lot of Jewish jugglers or acrobats.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a tradition of
that? In the Yiddish theater.
Really?
There were tons of it.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, if you think of Fiddler on the Roof, there's that great scene at the wedding where they dance with bottles on their heads. Well, this is, as I understand, still a tradition in the Hasidic community to have a lot of balancing and acrobatic feats performed at wedding ceremonies. I saw, do you know that there was a show called Image Before Mine Eyes, which was a documentary of the Jewish community in Poland, in the countryside, between the wars. So it wasn't about the Holocaust. And they had in that some home movies of a little shtetl, which is a little village, at market time, and there was a guy standing on a soapbox juggling two balls and his top hat.
Hmm.
So there's, I think, a great tradition of it.
The term new vaudeville is used a lot to describe what you do and what people like the Flying Karamazovs do. And
certainly is.
Yeah, Penn and Teller. And do you like that term? What does it mean to you?
It's all right. It's funny. About 10 years before that term was coined, when people said, well, what do you do? The best description I could come up with was, well, it's a kind of a vaudeville show, kind of a one-man vaudeville show with everything but the singing and dancing. I think what it means to me is performers who have taken skills that were used, traditional vaudeville skills, other than singing and dancing, and although even that stretch, because Bill Irwin is an incredible dancer and his show is largely based on dancing. But he does what you'd have to call eccentric dance. His body gets totally out of control of his head, which is a nice thing to see. Anyhow, people who have taken those skills, which were usually done in 9-minute segments. If you did a 10 or 12 minute turn in vaudeville, that was a long show, a long act, and you would do it all your life. People didn't change their shows, as I understand it. They really performed the same material over and over and over.
This was before television.
Yeah. But if you think of the early television, Ed Sullivan, you saw what the vaudeville acts were that came in. So it's people who have taken those vaudeville skills and adapted them to the theater and created full-length theatrical programs based on those skills.
But most of you, and I mean certainly in your act, you almost make jokes about what it is that you're doing. I mean, what you do in your act isn't just show off what an accomplished juggler you are or how you're able to walk across a slack rope.
There's I do that. I think in the case of the Karamazov brothers, they're showing off some of the most incredible juggling skills that have ever been seen. Penn and Teller are amazing magicians. Bill Irwin is an amazing dancer and clown.
But they're always making jokes about it and even undermining their skills.
They pretend to. They still fool the socks off you, so.
Right. do you think that, I mean, you really emphasize character in your act because you come out dressed in, you know, the baggy pants with the clown's nose and everything.
Yeah.
Why is it important for you to have a character?
Well, my background was in theater, and it was very important that my show be a play, not a show, that there is a sense of character development. For me, one of the keys of drama, of good drama, is that a character learns something, that a character change. So that at the end of the show, they're not the same character they were at the beginning. Something immutable has happened. There's been a dramatic change. And that was very important in developing my show. And it was the real breakthrough from being just a guy with a 10-minute rope-walking act who'd do anything to avoid doing it to finding a sense of a character who developed and changed through the show.
That's one of your things, right? Is that you don't want to. You're afraid you're not going to make it with the juggling.
Everybody's afraid I'm not going to.
but you do it at the end.
Ultimately.
Is there a real fear there that that you won't make it? Do you have any of the doubts that you convince the audience you really have?
No, not really. but then again, I do. So the walking the rope is still just as scary for me every time.
You're a pretty verbal person. You're not afraid to speak or anything, but you don't speak when you perform.
Well, I don't speak in this show when I perform. In The Jewel of the Nile, I spoke a lot. In Waiting for Godot, I could hardly shut up. And in Comedy of Errors, I did both. And I'm working on a new show now, which is going to be a combination of noises and gestures and some speaking also. So,
well, yeah, why in your show don't you speak, in your one-man show?
Well, I hate to say it, but it just kind of developed that way. I was doing the show and really casting around, pulling in all kinds of material, doing everything that I could do. And I had a speaking version, and I had a premise for speaking, and then I had the silent version. And I was doing a run out in California, in Eureka, California. I was working with Carlo Mazzoni Clementi at the time, and I did one show one night and the other show the other night, and he gave me one of the nicest advices that I ever got, which was to keep it silent, that when I was speaking, I was another funny actor and would be compared to other funny actors. But the stuff that I was doing silently was unique. There was no one doing that that kind of work at the time, or at least that's what he said. And that there was something very powerful and very magical about that silent character. I've since worked very hard in the show at doing the character in a way that a lot of times people don't know that I haven't spoken. They'll often come to me after the show and say, I really liked it when you said so-and-so to that woman in the front row. And I just look at them strangely and say, are you sure you heard me say something? The show works in a way that there's no point in it where speaking would be more efficient.
The word mime is in a lot of ways not very popular anymore. Mime is mocked on Saturday Night Live, and a lot of people are trying to disaffiliate themselves.
That's okay. Saturday
from
Night
Mime.
Live is mocked around places too.
That is true. do you think of yourself as a mime? When you say that you don't speak, do you have this urge to disassociate yourself from mime?
No, I think mime is a tool. Just the way I'm not. I wouldn't say, well, I'm a juggler, but I certainly juggle. I juggle baseball bats in the show. I think that mime has been, both got the greatest kick in the seat of the pants that it ever got from Marceau. He's the reason that most of us who perform silent theater do it, I think. In my case, directly, and in other people's cases, indirectly. But I think that he also made the world prisoner of the white face, if you'll excuse the term, cutesy blackout sketch as a mime. And people really have stuck with that definition of mime. They see it as white face, and they even call what Marceau does classical mime, when in fact he invented it certainly in well into this century. So I try to disassociate myself from that term because I think it's too restrictive and people have too many preconceptions about what the word means to understand what the show is or what other people are doing in this kind of an idiom.
Who did you study mime with?
I studied with Jacques Lecoq, excited to be meeting again. I haven't seen him in a long time, and he'll be here.
Did he have a theory of mime or a school of mime that you learned?
Oh, yeah. He has. Well, he calls his school a school of mime movement and theater. And what he calls mime is he defines it as the movement part of theater. So that on every stage, all over the world, if you turn the sound off, what you have is a mime show. And his mission, I guess, is to make that mime show better. Not to cut out the words, but to make all of the physical support for the character better.
Did you learn? I'm sorry.
You know, it's within a system. It's a very complicated system. It's a 2-year course of study, just the basic course.
Did you learn things that you could do with your face and, you know, with muscles in your eyes to cause expressions that you never knew before?
I learned this. People won't be able to see it, but you might be able to describe it. I'll show you something funny. I've never done this on the radio before.
Right, okay, what is happening is that Avner is standing straight up and his head is moving to the left and then moving to the right, but in such a way so that it looks like his head is almost standing still and his shoulders are changing their proportion.
That's exactly what was happening. I was keeping my head still in space. My body was moving under it.
Oh, your body really was moving.
Yeah.
Gives you a very distorted perception of what's happening. You were telling me you actually did mime on a Prairie Home Companion and Garrison narrated.
Yeah, I used to live in Minneapolis, and I really got one of my first breaks there at a sort of a coffee house theater called Dudley Riggs, and had, I don't know if you know them, Sean and Dave, Sean Blackburn, Dakota Dave Hall. Uh-huh. They were my opening act. Garrison was a real hero of mine, and this was before the show went national. It was just a local show in Minnesota. So he came down to see them, and I met him after the show, and he just kind of said, well, why don't you come down and do the show sometime? So we worked it out, and I did. And then I was fairly regular for a while, and I did about a half-hour warm-up for the audience. It was a huge theater, and then was actually on a couple of shows. I have a part of my show where I conduct the audience as an orchestra, and I did that actually on the air.
What do you conduct them doing?
They play a composition that I've written. They don't know they're doing it, though. It's something that develops. Well, it's too difficult to describe, but they end up playing this composition.
My guest is Avner the Eccentric, who is a juggler and clown and mime and one of the people who is referred to as a new vaudevillian. He had a one-man show that was very popular off-Broadway. He also was the jewel in the film, The Jewel of the Nile, and he's going to be performing in Philadelphia in June as part of a special festival that is going to happen in the city, and it's going to be a festival of miming and clowning that will be held from June 13th through July 11th, and his performance will be on June 27th. What about clowning? What are your associations with clowning? My associations are seeing Emmett Kelly on TV, seeing Red Skelton do his kind of clowns, and, you know, international circus and European circus.
Circus.
All the TV
kids,
circus shows.
Yeah. Kids.
Right, and Clarabelle
grocery
even.
Stores, gas station openings.
Mm-hmm.
Clowns have really got a bad rap in this country. They are the it's terrible. I think clowns are really associated with Bozo, and it's one of the battles that I've had to fight as a performer, is that the show that I do really isn't for kids. It's okay for some kids, and it's okay if there are a few kids in the audience, but it's not a kids show. And people hear that it's a clown, and they say, oh, boy, let's take the kids. Let's take the neighbor's kids. Let's get the whole block and go. And it's not always the most comfortable situation for me when that happens. The kind of clown that I am is really a European theatrical clown. And in Europe, much more so than here, in fact, hardly here at all, clowning is really revered and cherished as a serious part of theatrical tradition. And probably takes its roots much more from Shakespeare than from Bozo. The kind of clowning that I do is much more in line with what Chaplin and Keaton were doing than with what you'd ever see in any circus. I learned a little bit, or at least got my sort of introduction with Lecoq, and we worked with a red nose. And I think that's the thing that made it a clown character. One of the first things I do in the show is eat the nose. I make fun of it. I make fun of the clown idiom. And a lot of people can't see past that and say, oh, well, he's a clown because he looks like a clown. So it's my association is very strong, but I also try to play that down because I think people get trapped in their preconceptions of what a clown is and then don't see the show.
Do a lot of disappointed kids come when they say, oh, a clown will bring the kids, and I don't know if the kids would enjoy it.
I don't think anyone has ever been really disappointed at the show. What happens is this. The show, you quoted me in saying that the show was Emmett Kelly doing Waiting for Godot. One of the critics described it that way. I think it was in Chicago or Washington. He said this show is like Emmett Kelly wandering through a Beckett play. I described it once as Waiting for Godot with tricks. I think if if Beckett had understood the kinds of skills that I work with, as well as he understands the language, that's the kind of play he would have written. I did Waiting for Godot recently, and I it's about waiting. My show is about a character who gets trapped on stage and the sort of digressions. Now, there happen to be some amazing stunts. I balance a 14-foot stepladder. I walk a clothesline. I juggle baseball bats, balance a stack of 400 paper cups, et cetera. But what the show is really about are the digressions away from the tricks. The kids love the tricks, and they are fine for kids, but they really get antsy at the sort of character work that's going in. It's the kind of really subtle stuff that adults get that kind of goes right over kids' heads.
Could you have ever seen yourself, if it had been another era, entering the circus or the carnival or actually performing on the vaudeville stage?
Yeah, it's possible, although I never saw myself as a performer. I wanted to be a herpetologist.
That's studying reptiles?
Yeah, snakes mostly was my specialty. So I went off to college as an honors chemistry and biology major, and somehow ended up doing this. So looking back on it now, I suppose it's possible. I'm still fascinated with the kind of manipulation of objects.
What was the first stuff that you saw that got you really excited about the idea of juggling and magic?
Well, magic came a lot later. The first thing that I remember being excited about, juggling was incomprehensible to me as a young child, but I remember seeing these tap dance competitions on Ed Sullivan where they'd have a group of five guys and one guy would go out and do something and the next one would do something harder. I thought that was great. So I had badgered my parents into getting me a tap dance shoes. I must have been about 8 years old. And we had a little, they used to always dance up and down stairs, I remember. And we had a little step unit in the kitchen. I'd get out there and wail around and I just badgered them into letting me take tap dancing lessons. Boy, was that a boring shuffle ball change, shuffle ball change. I got kicked out of class. I couldn't stand it. I wanted to go up and down stairs and do flips and splits and all that. And we had to wear lipstick for our recital. So I misbehaved in class and got thrown out.
Did you try acrobatics after that?
Eventually in high school, I was a gymnast. Juggling I learned when I was 11 or 12 years old. From a guy who was just a skinny redheaded college kid at the time, who later went on to be pretty single-handedly responsible for most of the juggling you see in the country today, Hovey Burgess. He was at Florida State University as a student. They had a circus program which came up to Callaway Gardens, which is a little resort in central Georgia, and my family went there, and they ran a day camp program, and I learned to juggle there.
What were the first things you mastered?
I didn't master anything. I was trying rocks. I remember hitting myself a lot. Yeah, rocks and fruit. And then I think the next thing I got was I took some tennis balls and got some Rit dye and dyed me up some tennis balls and that and started juggling. Performed once in high school. Another guy and I had an act called the Throw-Ups. And we had a little, it was a little juggling act. But I juggled mostly recreationally. I didn't really start performing until midway through college.
Did you have a lot of catching up to do once you decided to perform seriously and professionally?
I kind of reinvented the wheel, so I didn't know it at the time, so I wasn't catching up anything. I studied theater, mostly tech theater. I was really interested in design, electricity, construction, welding, carpentry, all of that stuff. Took a few dance and acting classes, but was developing this clowning thing on the side.
When did you start performing on the streets?
Well, that was in 1966 in New Orleans. I was a student. I'd just gotten out of chemistry and biology and was sort of a theater major. And my best friend came to visit, and we ran out of money and decided we'd go out and juggle on the street. There weren't any street performers in those days. It hadn't happened yet. I remember there were some local kids who were tap dancing, and there was a Haitian guy who was fire-eating who we watched get arrested. And well, we thought that looked like fun, but we weren't ready to do fire-eating. I've since learned and had a career as a fire-eater, but quit doing it when I found out the medical hazards.
Whoa, like what?
Well,
calloused throat?
No, you're working with petrochemicals, which are absorbed through the mucous membranes in your mouth and throat, and they collect in your liver and can cause serious damage. I would advise anyone who's thinking of learning fire eating or anyone who's learned to do it not to do it, because the vapors and the liquid itself is very dangerous. Now, getting burned is the least of the problems. When I was doing it, there used to be a saying, there are no old fire eaters. But I worked as a fire eater and a fire spitter, fire breather, in a street circus in Paris. So anyhow, we were in New Orleans and decided to go out and juggle in the street. We didn't even have any juggling props. We had two-pound solid maple Indian clubs, the kind that you use for swinging and exercise, and some fruit. And one of us would juggle and the other one would talk and say things like, we were born hungry and we'll die hungry, but it feels so good to fill up in between, so please put something in our hats, folks. And that was our whole act.
You got arrested a couple of times, didn't you, when you were performing in the streets?
In New Orleans, we got stopped. They threatened to arrest us. In Paris, we actually got arrested. We were, it was the end of my first year at Lecoq, and a friend, Stanley Allen Sherman, and I decided to do a little show out at the Palais de Chaillot, right by the fountain. And it was a beautiful spring day. There must have been 2,000 or 3,000 people watching the show. And all of a sudden, we were surrounded by more police than I've ever seen in my life. It was just incredible. And they just picked us up and put us in a truck. The crowd started chanting for them not to, and it was almost a riot. And they took us to the police station, sat us in this room, and this vitriolic little Frenchman started pacing back and forth, just screaming at us and picking up our props and throwing them down and telling us that we were the scum of the earth and we were going to end up in the electric chair if we didn't stop being such derelicts. And we had this water gun that shot backwards. And he picked it up and he kept aiming it. We were just waiting.
Did he?
Well, I don't have to finish this story, do I?
Did he do it?
He sure did. All the other policemen were snickering. Well, we ended up doing a show in the police station for all the people there, and then they turned us loose. And I still have the ticket. I found it. I was going through some old papers, and I found the ticket. It says that the charge is buffoonerie au public, public buffoonery.
Gee, I didn't realize there would be such a charge. How did you learn how to, I think it's called walking the slack rope, basically walking along a clothesline that's high above the ground.
Yeah.
How'd you learn the kind of balance involved for that?
Well, I learned how to fall. And that was the main thing. I actually learned in a little street circus in Paris. I traded the guy juggling lessons, and he let me fall off his rope under the guise of teaching me. But that's really what happened. I used to try and teach it by teaching people to balance on it. I worked on a rope about 6 inches off the ground.
Uh-huh.
I worked for almost 5 years before I performed it. And I remember the first time I did it up high, and it was just this quantum leap of, and I had to go, well, wait a minute, it's the same rope, it's just higher. And I did it. It was really scary.
Well, when you learned how to fall, you learned to fall from 6 inches above the ground, which isn't such a dramatic fall as when you're, 10 feet or 20 feet above the ground.
Well, it's not the fall that hurts you.
It's not?
Uh-uh. It's the sudden stop.
Well, excuse me?
It's the sudden stop.
What do you mean?
Well, when you hit the ground.
Uh-huh.
I've had some pretty bad falls. I used to teach it by trying to teach people how to balance on the rope. And I was a terrible teacher. I couldn't get anyone to do it. And one day I was watching a baby learn how to walk. I got to observe a child of some friends downstairs in our apartment in Minneapolis. And what I saw her doing was picking herself up, walking a little bit, and then falling. And I realized what she was doing was learning how to fall, not how to walk. And when she got real good at falling, then she got good at walking. So I started pushing people off the rope.
So that way they wouldn't be afraid of what would happen if they
that
fell?
And a bit more complicated. When you stand on the rope, you're on one leg.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a strong side, and it's easy to fall that way because you can get something under you. Falling to the other side is terrifying because the rope flips you upside down and you land on your shoulder. So nobody wants to fall that way. Now, the middle is defined by the ends. Wherever something is balanced, as far as it'll go one way and the other way is what defines where the middle's going to be, where your safe zone is. Well, if you're always cheating it to one side because that side's safe, then you're never going to learn to balance in the middle. You're constantly going to be cheating that way. So what I started doing was arranging lots of mats and people to catch them, and I would purposefully off-balance them in that direction. So that they got used to falling that way, then it wasn't so terrifying. Then they could start to really work on it. So it was a 6-month-old baby, or I forget how old she was. How old do kids when they learn to walk? 9 months?
About 10 months.
10 months? We'll call it that. However old she was,
I don't know.
When little Otto was learning to walk, that's what taught me how to teach the slack rope.
I think I'm glad I didn't study with you. You'd have me falling all the time. Have you hurt yourself badly when you fell?
Nothing irreparable. I spraining both wrists seemed to be the mode for a while.
Yeah, not perfect for a juggler.
No.
I'm speaking with Avner the Eccentric, and he juggles and walks the wire and does a lot of very kooky things. He's had a one-man show in New York off-Broadway that was very successful. He starred as the Jewel in the Jewel of the Nile, and he's going to be performing in Philadelphia June 27th at the Annenberg Center as part of a festival of mime and clowns. It's a mime and clown festival that will run in Philadelphia from June 13th through July 11th. So now that you know how to walk the slack rope. I mean, that's not good enough. It's not good enough to just show you could do it, right?
'Cause it wasn't good enough for me.
Mm-hmm. So how have you made it into something more theatrical?
That's a good question. That's actually one of the things that is most interesting to me about the show is what to do with these skills once you do them.
Because we've all seen them on variety shows. And it,
precisely.
You know, we're not that impressed anymore, especially in the age of special effects, because you assume that with the right technology, people can fake anything.
Yeah. And Philippe Petit has walked the World Trade Center.
Oh, sure, that's right.
What's this guy going to do with a clothesline? Well, but who's the guy? You know, if Wally Cox was going to be walking the rope, you'd... Exactly. The problem, as I see it, well, first of all, you know that if you see a juggler do three, you're going to want to see four. And if you see four, you want to see five. So to me, the best jugglers are the ones who do three but do amazing things with them. The job of the playwright actor, I guess, which is what a singer-songwriter in the theater is a playwright actor, is to create a sense of empathy rather than sympathy in the minds of the and the hearts of the audience, to get them worrying along with the character, putting themselves in that character's place. As soon as they're worried about the character walking the rope, all he has to do is barely make it across, and he's a huge success. So that's what I've worked for, is to find a psychological connection with the audience so that they are able to enter into a state of empathy. And then we're working together to solve this problem. When a juggler shows up with chrome-plated juggling clubs, beautifully taped in a slick costume, he's got to do something pretty impressive because you know that he can juggle. When he shows up with some ratty old baseball bats, which he can't even hold to begin with, you begin to wonder. So that was the part of the scheme of developing that character aspect. One of the greatest tools I have is something I actually learned from Arthur Koestler, from actually an analysis of his analysis of some kinds of humor. He calls it bisociation. But very briefly, what it is that if you can create expectations in the minds of the audience and violate those expectations, you can get a laugh or at least a surprise. So I work with that a lot, convincing the audience that I'm not going to walk the rope and then not walking it, and then convincing them that I'll be crazy to walk it and not walking it, and then convincing them that, well, I might try it, but I'll probably kill myself and not doing it. And when they finally give up, do it.
And yeah, and that's always very funny because it does violate your expectations.
Yeah.
Many of our listeners, unfortunately not me, has gotten to see you in Jewel of the Nile. And well, it's coming out on cassette.
Okay.
Video cassette. How did you get that role? How did they find out about you? The Flying Karamazovs were also in that movie.
Yeah. They played they were the Sufi version of the cavalry. They rode in and saved the day, juggling sabers on camelback. Well, I got asked to do it. It was like right out of a movie. I was doing my show on Broadway, actually off Broadway at that time. Got a call from my agent, who said that Michael Douglas's office had called, would I have drinks with him on Monday? Well, I had just bought this cottage in Maine, and I had to get up there and get the plumbing arranged. I said, no, I wouldn't have drinks with him on Monday. I was going to be out of town. How about Tuesday? And couldn't he go find out what they wanted? Because I'm very embarrassed about meeting movie stars and cocktail parties and all that.
You thought he just wanted a hobnob with a famous juggler.
I didn't know what he wanted. Anyhow, so my agent said, Avner, you got to start meeting these people. And I said, look, Tim, find out what's going on, okay? Well, he called me back later. He said, they've been on the phone from California all day. It's not drinks. It's dinner and the director of the movie. And I knew, because the Karamazovs are good friends of mine, I knew about the film. I knew that it was happening. I had read a script and it never occurred to me that they were looking for a jewel. The jewel was described as a short, fat, bald-headed Englishman, sort of a character. And I had this fantasy that they were going to ask me to be, to sort of join them as an accessory juggler or something. So, and I had the show running and I really wasn't sure that I wanted to do it, and it was a very confusing time. Anyhow, they said, well, it's dinner, and the director of the film and Michael want to have dinner with you. And so we had dinner, and they described the film to me, the plot, and they said, how'd you like to be the Jewel? And I tried to talk them out of it, and luckily they talked me into it.
What'd you say to talk them out of it?
Well, I pointed out that I don't speak. They had seen my show. I said, well, look, you know, I don't speak. They said, that's okay. We've been talking to you tonight. It'll be fine. I said, well, this guy has to have an Arabic accent. They said, that's okay. We'll get dialogue coaches. I said, but there's experienced actors. They said, we want you to do it. So I remembered the few acting jobs that I'd done and said, well, all right, I'll give it a try. And I'm very happy that I did.
You had to work in the desert in very high temperatures, right?
Yeah.
What did you have to do to keep cool while
you were performing? I was actually the coolest one on the set. I was dressed in traditional Arab desert garb. I had a thick cotton turban and a flowing robe, a jalaba. So I was the most comfortable of the bunch, I think. It wasn't so bad. It was far more uncomfortable in France at 85 degrees than it was at 120 or 130 in Morocco, because in Morocco it was very dry. And you don't feel the heat. You have to be careful to drink a lot. But it was so dry that you couldn't sweat. There's a scene in the movie where we're running through the desert, and Michael and Kathleen have to be perspiring. And they couldn't. We were running wind sprints all afternoon, and they couldn't sweat. So they had a little plant sprayer hidden behind a rock, and they'd spray each other. The Jewel was beatific and glowed, so he didn't have to sweat.
Do you want to do more movies now?
Yeah, I'd like to.
Did you improvise any of the feats that you had to do?
Yeah. Yeah, quite a bit. Actually, the whole scene, when you see the film where I distract the crowd in the Nubian village, was improvised. The director said, okay, we've got all seven cameras turned on. It's only costing us $10,000 a minute. Have fun. And I did. I had a ball. I did a little street show for all the extras, and they taped it, and it's what got into the film.
Do you wish that Ed Sullivan still had his show so you could go on and do your act?
I hadn't really thought much about it. I don't really have a nine-minute act that works on television. I've done some television shows, and they haven't been, for me, the most successful things that I've done, because my show is all based on,
this character
and these digressions. So I've taken some things out of it and reworked them for television. I'm getting more comfortable with it. I've done a few. The last couple that I've done, I've been pretty proud of. It's, you know, I guess it's a job, so sure.
Okay, so what do you see in your future?
Well, keep working. Mm-hmm. Just bought a house on a little island in Maine, and I get to mow the grass now. That's the great equalizer, you know.
Do you get any problems like juggler's arm or any problems of the trade?
Funny you should mention that. Yeah, I actually have developed a case of tendonitis, which I'm calling juggler's elbow in honor of tennis elbow, which has kept me out of work for the past 6 months.
Really?
It started, I was on tour, and it developed when I was in Boston last November, and haven't been able to do the full show since then. And have been seeing a variety of doctors who have their own opinions about it. I've had doctors recommend ice and others recommend heat. I do both. So, that develops. There's always something that hurts. We used to come backstage after our show at Dudley Riggs and say, boy, this is more like professional football than art.
Because you're always in pain.
You're always getting bruised up or something, but you just work around it.
Yeah, dancers are always in pain also.
Yeah. I used to be a puppeteer, and the most often asked question was, how do you keep the strings from getting tangled? And the answer was, you don't. You learn how to work them tangled. How do you keep yourself from getting hurt? Well, you do everything you can, but you learn to work with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure
about
to talk
what
to you.
Do, and thank you very much for being here. My guest has been Avner the Eccentric, who's done his one-man show in New York and will be bringing it to Philadelphia on June 27th. Well, he'll perform at the Annenberg Center at 36th and Walnut Streets. Avner the Eccentric's performance is just one part of the Mime and Clown Festival, which will be held in Philadelphia from June 13th through July 11th. And it's going to feature performances, a three-day conference, master classes, and it was put together by a panel of artists and theater and dance critics. The performances will be held at the Annenberg Center and the Painted Bride Art Center. Since there's so much information, I'll just give you a phone number and you can call for details. It's 751-0131. That's 751-0131. And Avner, thanks again for being here.
It's a pleasure.
It's 17 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Why? Because we love you.